From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Bart Ehrman was born again when he was in high school. That meant he accepted Christ into his heart and believed that the New Testament was the inerrant Word of God. His studies at the Moody Institute in the early 1970s confirmed his beliefs, and it wasn't until his first semester at Princeton Theological Seminary that his faith in the literalness of the Bible was shaken. That epiphany inspired a career of learning ancient languages and studying the Bible, and ultimately led him to write Misquoting Jesus, the story behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. It's published by Harper San Francisco. I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
When you began your studies at Princeton, wasn't it your intention to bring an evangelical slant to the more secular interpretations of the Bible that are taught at non-Christian universities?
That was my goal. I wanted to be an evangelical voice in the university setting, and I went to Princeton in part because I thought that would give me the kind of degree that I would need to get into that setting.
So what led to your epiphany that you probably were on the wrong track?
Well, as I learned Greek, which was the original language of the New Testament, and learned Hebrew, then the language of the Old Testament, and started studying these texts in the original languages, I began to realize that my earlier belief that these were texts that didn't have mistakes in them was erroneous, that in fact there were mistakes in these texts.
What was the text that first got you started?
Well, it's actually just a small little text that is a minute problem, but there's a passage in the Gospel of Mark where Jesus is being accused by his enemies, the Pharisees, because his followers have been eating grain on the Sabbath. And Jesus reminds his enemies that this is comparable to something that happened in the Hebrew Bible when David went into the temple to eat the showbread that only the priests were supposed to eat, and Jesus says this happened when Abiathar was the high priest. Well, I came to realize as I studied this text that, in fact, this happened in the Hebrew Bible not when Abiathar was the high priest, but when his father Ahimelech was the high priest. And this was the first time that I noticed something that I thought was just an unambiguous mistake in the text.
What was your professor's response?
Well, I actually wrote, the reason I was studying this is I was writing a term paper, an interpretation of the passage. I wrote a very long 35-page paper that argued that, in fact, it was not a mistake. It was a complicated argument based on the Greek grammar of the verse. And at the end of this paper, which my professor liked, but at the end of it, he just wrote a simple note that said, well, maybe Mark made a mistake. And I thought about it, and realizing all the exegetical footwork I had to do to make it clear Mark had not made a mistake, I thought, well, maybe, in fact, Mark did make a mistake.
Well, what did you think Mark was doing by making this mistake? And what would it have been Mark's mistake, or might it have been somebody else's mistake down the line?
Well, one of the questions was whether it was a mistake that Jesus himself had made, that maybe he had misread the passage. But I was inclined to think that probably the author of the Gospel of Mark is the one who simply made this small mistake.
But it doesn't challenge your faith.
No, not at all. I mean, what does it matter if it's Ahimelech or Abiathar, who is the high priest? This isn't something that the Nicene Creed depends upon. But once I realized that there could be a small mistake in the text, it made me also realize there could be bigger mistakes. And once I realized that, then the floodgates opened and things changed rather drastically.
Well, one of the points you make in your book is that the Bible was copied by hand each time over and over, over centuries. Maybe you can give us a brief chronology of when the New Testament was first written, although isn't there still a bit of disagreement as to that, and what texts were available to these scribes?
Yeah, so the book that I've just written, Misquoting Jesus, is about these scribes who copied their texts. The texts of the New Testament were originally written, most of them in the first century A.D., so within 40, 50, 60 years of Jesus' death, they were written.
There are some who argue that at least one of them was written by an eyewitness.
Some people have argued that, but I think most critical scholars today think that that the Gospels were written probably 40 or 50 years after Jesus, not by eyewitnesses. The letters of Paul are actually somewhat earlier than the Gospels. Some of the other letters in the New Testament are somewhat later than the Gospels. When we go to a bookstore today to buy a New Testament, of course, we have the 27 books of the New Testament in the same sequence and in an English translation. But for most of Christian history, it didn't work that way. People didn't have entire books of the New Testament. They had individual books. And these were books that were not run off on printing presses, but they were copied by scribes. So in the early centuries, of course, scribes were Christians who could copy these texts, and they copied them one page, one sentence, one word at a time. And the point of my book is that often these scribes changed the text.
On purpose or by accident? Sometimes people just make mistakes or slips of the pen.
Well, in fact, probably most of the changes in our manuscripts are simply slips of the pen. And a lot of the changes just show that scribes in antiquity could spell no better than people can today. So you have that kind of mistake, which isn't very significant for anything. But there are other kinds of changes of the text that look like scribes have intentionally made and that, in fact, alter the meaning of the text.
Including adding stories.
Adding stories, taking away stories, changing stories, the whole gamut.
Bart D. Ehrman, Ehrman, whose previous book is Lost Christianities, has just written Misquoting Jesus, the story behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. It's published by Harper San Francisco. This is WNYC 93.9 and WNYC.org on AMA 20. You can hear gavel-to-gavel coverage of the confirmation proceedings for Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court. So stories were added and things changed. For example, you point out that one of the most beloved stories in John chapter 8 of the woman accused of adultery was written later by a scribe.
Well, that's right. It's probably the most famous story in the Gospels. It's certainly the one that gets into all the Hollywood movies. Jesus is teaching in the temple, and some Jewish leaders come up to him with a woman who's been caught in the act of adultery, and they ask Jesus, "What should we do with her? The law of Moses says we're to stone her to death. And what do you say?" This puts Jesus in this dilemma, because if he says, "Yes, go ahead and stone her," then he's violating his teaching about love and mercy. On the other hand, if he says, no, let her go, then he's breaking the law of Moses. And so what's he to do? Well, he stoops down and begins writing on the ground. And then he looks up and he says, "Let the one without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her." And they all start feeling guilty for their own sins, and they leave one by one until Jesus looks up again, and there's just the woman there. And he says, "Is there no one here to condemn you?" And woman says, "No, Lord, no one." And Jesus says, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." It's a beautiful story, and it encapsulates many of Jesus' teachings about love and mercy. The problem is that it's not in any of our early manuscripts of the Gospel of John.
I can't say the original, because we don't have an original, but
we don't have
ones that predate this one. When does this one turn up?
Well, we have it in 1/5 century manuscript, so 400 years after the Gospel of John was written. It doesn't start showing up regularly in Greek manuscripts until the Middle Ages. We don't have any of the Greek church fathers who commented on the Gospel of John who show any evidence of knowing this story until the 12th century. So for many hundreds of years, the Gospel of John circulated without this story.
But does this change the view of Jesus, or does it augment what other aspects of John are giving us about him? Or is this something that reflects changes in attitudes starting in the 5th century?
Well, it's a very good question, because people have wondered about this story and have wondered, maybe some scribes wanted to put it in because they thought that that the rules for penitence were too harsh, and they wanted in the 5th, 6th centuries, and maybe they wanted to show that, in fact, Jesus had a more lax attitude toward penitence, so that if you sin, you could be forgiven without having to pay a price. Other people thought that might be what would have led some scribes to want to take the story out, because it has too lax of an attitude. attitude toward sin. And so these are the kinds of debates that, in fact, affected the text of the New Testament. And scribes were copying this text over the hundreds and thousands of years.
Do you get a sense that certain stories came and went because of changing attitudes?
Yeah, absolutely. There are different changes in the text that happen. Sometimes a scribe will change the text, and then a later scribe will come back and change it back the way it was, or change it yet a third way. I should say, in respect to this, that when I'm laying out the theory that scribes change the text, it's not really a theory. It's more, this is, I think, something that people would consider to be a fact, because we have thousands of manuscripts of the New Testament, and no two of these manuscripts are exactly alike in all their particulars. So there are hundreds of thousands of changes in these manuscripts.
We were just talking about a leper colony. You have a story about how Jesus really acted when he was approached by a leper. That story also has been changed.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. It's in Mark chapter 1. Jesus is approached by this leper, and the leper says, if you're willing to cleanse me, I'll be cleansed. And Jesus says, I am willing. And in most English translations, it says, feeling compassion for the man, Jesus reached out and touched him and healed him. It's interesting that in some of our earliest manuscripts, in fact, it doesn't say that Jesus felt compassion for the man. It says, Jesus, getting angry, reached out his hand and touched him. And so, well, it makes a pretty big difference how you read the story, if Jesus is feeling compassion or if he's getting angry.
Well, why would he get angry and then reach out to touch him?
Well, that's a very good question. That would be a question of interpretation then. If you can establish that the text originally said Jesus got angry, you'd have to ask what was he getting angry about? And there are a lot of theories about that. One, the theory that I like is that in Mark's gospel, Jesus does get angry on other occasions, and it's always when somebody is ready to be healed. And in this particular case, he might have gotten angry because the man says, if you're willing, you're able to cleanse me. And Jesus is a little ticked off about that. Of course I'm willing to cleanse you. And so he reaches out his hand and heals him.
In this case, you said it occurred during translation. So in some instances, we have scribes just copying and sometimes accidentally changing things, sometimes purposely changing things. And then we have translations as well. I'm assuming, again, some of the translations, the mistakes were inadvertent, and some were also there, as translators sometimes do, to clean things up a bit.
Well, that's right. You know, we have modern translations into English, of course, but in early Christianity, the Bible was translated into other common languages, and so we have translations into Latin and into Syriac and into Coptic and into a range of other languages, and every time you translate something, of course, you somewhat change its meaning.
But what about changing the view of Jesus along the way?
Well, anytime you change a story, you change the way the characters in the story are being portrayed, and so what we end up with in the modern today are thousands of manuscripts, many of which have different portrayals of Jesus.
Weren't there also changes in the account of Luke about Jesus sweating blood as he prayed in the garden?
Yeah, this is another very interesting passage. It's the passage that we get this phrase, sweating blood, from. It's found only in Luke's gospel. Jesus is it's right before his arrest, and he's off praying that God will relieve him of this cup. And in some of our manuscripts, it says he began to sweat great drops as if of blood, and an angel came down and ministered to him. And so this is this famous scene of Jesus sweating blood. Unfortunately, that passage is not found in our earliest and best manuscripts of the Gospel of Luke. And so probably originally Luke didn't have this indication of Jesus sweating blood at all. And without this passage in Luke, it's very interesting because Luke otherwise doesn't portray Jesus as at all bothered about his coming fate. In Luke's Gospel otherwise, Jesus is completely calm and in control of what's happening to him, which is in some contrast with the way he's portrayed in the Gospel of Mark.
Well, this sounds like that part of the process is in making Jesus seem more human over the years.
Yeah, that's one of the things that was motivating scribes. Some scribes wanted to portray Jesus as more human.
The Son of God?
Well, not rather than the Son of God, but they wanted to stress that even though he was God, he was also human. This is because there were some early Christians who said that since Jesus was God, he couldn't be a man. And scribes were against that point. Some scribes were against that point of view, and so they made Jesus more and more human as a result.
On the other hand, one of the most startling revelations in your book is that one verse in the New Testament that explicitly states the doctrine of the Trinity is from the King James Bible. Those verses aren't found in any of the Greek manuscripts down through the 14th century.
Yeah, this is one of the most interesting and important changes in the text. It's a kind of a complicated story, but it's really interesting. The first person to give us a printed Greek New Testament, in other words, not a handwritten manuscript, but a New Testament run off the printing press in Greek, was a man named Erasmus in the 16th century. And when Erasmus had printed his first Greek New Testament, he left out verses from 1 John chapter 5, verses 7 and 8, which are the only verses in the entire New Testament that explicitly confirm the doctrine of the Trinity.
Now, this is the famous Erasmus from the Netherlands?
Yes, that's right, the humanist scholar from the Netherlands. This verse in 1 John says, in the text found in the Latin tradition, it says that there are three witnesses in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Spirit, and these three are one. Well, that's a statement of the Trinity, the three persons who make up one God. When Erasmus printed his Greek New Testament, he didn't include these verses. And so the Latin theologians just went crazy and got very angry at him and said that he was taking the Trinity out of the Bible. And Erasmus replied that none of his Greek manuscripts had these verses. They only were found in the Latin translation. And he was printing a Greek Bible. And he challenged his theologian opponents that if they could produce a Greek manuscript that had these verses in it, that he would include it in his next edition. And as it turns out then, they literally produced a Greek manuscript. They had somebody copy out the Greek text by hand. And when they got to these verses, this person translated them back from Latin into Greek, inserted them into 1 John, and Erasmus then was true to his word. He included these verses in his next edition of the Greek New Testament, and it was that edition that was used by the King James translators.
But it's something that is accepted by Christians, by Catholics all over the world. I remember the great painting, the great fresco by Masaccio of the Holy Trinity. That's from the early 15th century.
Well, that's right. So I'm not saying that the doctrine of the Trinity is invalid or anything like that. What I'm saying is that the only verse that explicitly affirmed it in the New Testament, in fact, wasn't originally in the New Testament.
But can we also say that Erasmus, like so many other people, pushed the things that he found most conducive to his own idea of how the Bible should be interpreted and got rid of the things that he found didn't really jibe with what he believed?
He may have done that some, but not in this instance. I mean, in this instance, we don't have any Greek manuscripts that have the verse. And so he was actually just giving us the text that he found in the manuscripts that were available to him.
My guest is Bart D. Ehrman. His book, Misquoting Jesus, The Story Behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. It is published by Harper San Francisco. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Bart D. Ehrman, who chairs the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, an authority on the history of the New Testament, the early church, and the life of Jesus. He has taped several highly popular lecture series for the Teaching Company, as the author of The Last Christianities, The Battle for Scripture and the Faiths We Never Knew, and Lost Scriptures, Books That Did Not Make It into the New Testament, and now Misquoting Jesus, The Story Behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. It is published by Harper San Francisco. There's been a lot of scholarship in recent years as to what wound up in the final version of the New Testament. And this seems to be something that we usually associate with the Middle Ages or earlier. Now it turns out it was continuing into the 15th century, into the Protestant Reformation.
The copying of manuscripts, yeah.
But the changes that were occurring, did the change occur further with the Protestant Reformation?
There were changes made whenever somebody would translate the text, and the problem with copying a text by hand is that any time you make a copy, you people just accidentally make mistakes, and people will frequently see something that's not there on the page. And so that would happen down even into the Reformation period when the printing press, of course, had been invented. Manuscripts were still being copied by hand, and there were still changes being made in the text on occasion.
What about the Old Testament?
Well, with the Old Testament, it's even a bigger problem, as it turns out. Until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, our earliest manuscript of the Hebrew Bible dated from the year 1000 A.D. With the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we suddenly had texts of the Hebrew Bible that were 1,000 years earlier than anything that had previously been in existence. And people had commonly thought that the Jewish scribes had been so scrupulous in their copying practices that they didn't change a single letter on the page. But the Dead Sea Scrolls now show us that, in fact, changes were being made also in the text of the Hebrew Bible.
So even if we had had complete knowledge of how to speak Aramaic and ancient Hebrew, we still couldn't have known about the changes until the Dead Sea Scrolls turned up.
We could have surmised some changes because of the translations of the Hebrew Bible into other languages. The Greek Old Testament, called the Septuagint, is different in a number of ways from the Hebrew text. And so probably Jewish scribes were kind of like Christian scribes. They sometimes made mistakes.
But it was easier for you to track this in the New Testament because you do have an understanding of ancient Greek?
Right. Most of the important manuscripts, of course, are actually in Greek itself. And so to do this kind of study, you have to know Greek and a handful of other languages.
What does this mean for people who do believe that the Bible is just the inerrant word of God?
Well, when I started out in this kind of study, I was an evangelical Christian who believed that the Bible had no mistakes in it. And that was actually what got me interested in this kind of study in the first place. My view was that if the Bible had no mistakes originally, then we ought to know what the original words were. And so my decision to learn Greek and to start studying Greek manuscripts was rooted in a belief that we had to get back to the originals in order to know what were the inspired words. What happened, as I was referring to earlier, is that in the process of my study, I changed my views, and I began to realize that, in fact, there were mistakes. And I could see mistakes all over the place in the manuscripts that survived, but then I came to believe that, in fact, there were probably mistakes in the originals themselves.
Well, how did you come to be an evangelical Christian in the first place? Weren't you brought up an Episcopalian?
Yeah, I was raised in Lawrence, Kansas, in an Episcopal church, which certainly wasn't fundamentalist. But I had a born again experience in high school, and
what did your parents think of that?
Well, my parents actually later themselves also became evangelical Christians, born again. And my mother, who's still living, is still a very strong evangelical Christian woman. So that I've completely changed my perspective, but they're still there.
Tell us about the Moody Institute. What was its appeal to you?
Well, so when I converted when I became an evangelical Christian in high school, I had a kind of a spiritual guru who told me that if I wanted to be a serious Christian, I'd go to Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. And this is a place where it's a very rigorous, ultra-conservative evangelical. I suppose it's a fundamentalist Bible college. And so I went there because I wanted to be serious about my faith and wanted to become an intelligent Christian.
In the 70s, at a time when this was and that kind of school was an oddity. Today, it's quite different.
Yeah, it was a bit of an oddity. It was, I guess you could look upon it as kind of a strange Christian counterculture in a way. It was kind of a Christian boot camp, really.
And then you went on to get a B.A. in literature at Wheaton, which had to have been a certain culture shock.
It was a bit of a shock. Wheaton is a very strong evangelical college, but it's a liberal arts college where people aren't studying simply the Bible and theology. They're studying philosophy and history and literature. And so this started, I think, my movement away from evangelical Christianity because I started seeing that there's a very big world out there and there's a lot of literature out there and there are a lot of philosophies out there and it's a very big place we live in.
But do you think your life would have turned out very differently if you hadn't entered Princeton Theological Seminary and started reading all the different texts in ancient Greek?
Well, I actually was deciding between going to a place like Princeton Seminary or a place like Dallas Theological Seminary, which is a bastion of fundamentalism. And I chose to go to Princeton Seminary because the person who was the scholar who was the leading expert on Greek manuscripts, a man named Bruce Metzger, happened to teach at Princeton Seminary. And so I wanted to go to Princeton to study with him. But in my courses, not directly with Professor Metzger, but with other professors there at Princeton Seminary, I started acquiring an entirely different view of what the Bible was, and that changed everything for me.
Well, for someone who still wants to have the most accurate Bible, is there such a thing?
Well, there are a lot of translations that are available. My own opinion is that the New Revised Standard Version is probably the most accurate translation available, but there are others that could probably lay claim to being most accurate as well. But any translation you have, of course, is going to change the meanings of the words simply by virtue of the fact that it's a translation.
Some people complain about the New Revised Standard Version because it lacks the poetry of the King James.
Well, the King James is obviously the best translation in the English language if what you're looking for is a literary classic. The New Revised Standard Version doesn't have as powerful a poetic character, but the King James translation was based on late medieval manuscripts that in many places were embodying changes of the text. And so if you want to know what the text originally said, you're better off with a more recent translation like the New Revised Standard Version.
Wasn't the Protestant Reformation all about personalizing a Christian's relationship to God through the Bible? What does that mean if the Bible had already been filtered through any number of previous interpretations?
Well, that is a problem. One of the cries of the Reformation was sola scriptura, scripture alone. For people who want to base their beliefs simply on the scriptures, well, there is this issue that we don't have the originals of any of the writings of the biblical authors. And what we have are copies that were made hundreds of years later, many of which have been changed in significant ways. And so how does one base belief on a text that's been changed?
Is there no Christian equivalent of the Dead Sea Scrolls?
With the New Testament text, we're in a better situation than with the Hebrew Bible, because for the Hebrew Bible, we had 1,000 years in which there were no copies. We have copies of the New Testament, some very tiny fragments the size of a credit card that go back to within probably, 40 or 50 years of when the books were originally written. And then we start getting full copies decades, centuries after that. Our first complete copy of the New Testament is from around the year 350, so about 300 years after the originals were made. So that puts us in much better shape than we have for the Hebrew Bible.
My guest is Bart D. Ehrman, Ehrman. His latest book, Misquoting Jesus, The Story Behind Who Changed the Bible and Why, from Harper, San Francisco. You started off, you said, noticing some discrepancies between what was written in one of the versions of the New Testament and the Old Testament. Aren't there still many areas of conflict? What happened when the old scribes and scholars noticed that certain things in the New Testament perhaps were in conflict with things in the Old Testament?
Well, this is one kind of change that gets made frequently in our manuscripts, is that when a scribe notices some kind of discrepancy, the scribe will change it so that there's no longer a discrepancy. And this happens not only between the New Testament and the Old Testament, but also with parallel passages in the New Testament. In other words, where you have the Gospel of Mark telling a story and the Gospel of Matthew telling the same story, but they tell it in different ways, scribes will harmonize those two passages so they say exactly the same thing. It's interesting, when you read our earliest manuscripts, you get fewer of these harmonizations, and as time goes on, scribes did it more and more. A key place for this, for example, is the Lord's Prayer. You get a version of the Lord's Prayer in the Gospel of Luke, which sounds strange to modern ears because it's missing about half of the prayer. The Gospel of Matthew has a fuller version of the Lord's Prayer, the one that people are more familiar with. Scribes are also more familiar with it, and so they often change Luke's text so that it coincided with the text of Matthew.
Aren't there also conflicting reports about Jesus on the cross?
Well, absolutely. One of the most interesting is in Luke's gospel. Luke is distinctive for portraying Jesus as being very calm and in control at his death. And when he's being nailed to the cross, only in Luke's gospel, Jesus prays, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." A famous saying of Jesus that in Luke's gospel probably refers to Jesus praying for forgiveness for the Jewish people who are responsible for turning him over to the Romans. And that verse was interpreted that way in the early church, that this was a prayer of Jesus for forgiveness for the Jews. And so it's quite interesting to see that some manuscripts take out that prayer. And you wonder, well, why would a scribe want to get rid of that prayer? Well, it's probably because there were lots of Christians in the early centuries who thought that God did not forgive the Jews, that in fact God had Jerusalem destroyed precisely because they rejected Jesus. And so they removed the prayer from his lips because they think God hadn't forgiven them.
And that argument continues to this day, as we saw when a certain film was released last year.
Absolutely. As it turns out, Mel Gibson agreed to take out the line, "His blood be upon us and our children," a line taken from the Gospel of Matthew. I'm not sure if everybody knows this, but in fact, Mel Gibson didn't take out that line from the movie. He simply didn't translate it in the subtitles.
So it's in the Aramaic.
It's in the Aramaic, yeah.
Although it has also been pointed out that nobody would have spoken Aramaic at that time. They probably would have spoken Greek.
The movie's peculiar on a lot of levels. The most peculiar linguistic peculiarity is when Jesus is on trial before Pontius Pilate, all of a sudden he launches into fluent Latin, which is a bit of a howler for scholars who know anything about the period.
How do you react to all of the people who use the Bible as a source for political positions, whether it's abortion, homosexuality, premarital sex, or pretty much anything else? And for a while, it was also slavery, wasn't it? A justification for slavery was found, and for apartheid,
yes,
in the New Testament, or the Old Testament.
What I've come to realize is that the Bible is a very human book. When I started seeing that the scribes changed their text, I realized that all of these manuscripts are different because the scribes were different. And if you reason backwards from there, you begin to realize that the authors of the books themselves were different, with different points of view and different perspectives on a wide range of issues.
So there's a kind of a Rashomon effect here?
Well, what happens is you have this wide range of diversity in these early Christian texts, and anybody can quote a text for whatever purpose they want because there are lots of different points of view represented. So that if you're opposed to women in the church, you can quote one author. If you're in favor of women in the church, you can quote a different author. So this kind of proof texting by picking and choosing, I think, isn't really very appropriate. And it's done especially today, for example, to oppress women, but also to oppose gay rights, because people quote passages which condemn homosexuality. They don't quote the other passages that say that if you disobey your parents, you're to be stoned to death, or that you can't wear mixed cloth. So you pick and choose what you want, and I personally don't find that use of the Bible to be very palatable.
But it has led to the creation of many different denominations because some people interpret differently than others.
Well, that's right, and it all comes down to the belief that the Bible is without mistake, but in fact there are mistakes in the Bible because the Bible was written by humans. It wasn't just copied by humans so that mistakes entered into the manuscripts. It was actually written by humans in the first place, and so we need to treat this as a very human book and put it in its own historical context.
More than 2.5 billion copies of the Bible have been sold since 1815, and every year the Bible is the best-selling and most widely distributed book in the world, been translated into over 2,200 languages and dialects. So it still remains, even though Christianity is not the largest religion in the world, the most read book of faith in the world?
Absolutely. The most read, the most believed, the most widely misunderstood, I would argue, that, and largely misunderstood because people don't try to situate it in its own historical context, but rip it out of its context.
Bart D. Ehrman's book is called Misquoting Jesus. It is published by Harper San Francisco. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.